Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Newsmakers from America and around the world speak with journalists in an unscripted and unrehearsed discussion about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. Here is your host on this edition of Press Conference USA, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our special guest on this edition of the program is Matthew Duss. He's president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Established in 1979, the foundation is dedicated to promoting, through various activities, a just solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict that brings peace and security to both peoples. Prior to his recent appointment as president of the foundation, Matthew Duss was a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. That's a liberal think tank here in Washington. He's a widely published journalist and policy analyst. And Matthew is also an expert in Middle East affairs and has traveled extensively in the region, including in Israel and Palestine. Well, you may recall that last week we spoke to retired Israeli Major General Amnon Reshef about his efforts to jumpstart moribund peace talks between Israelis and Palestinians by first persuading the Israeli government and all political leaders to formulate a robust response to the Arab Peace Initiative, first proposed in 2002 by recently deceased King Abdullah of Saudi Arabia. That initiative attempts to end the Arab-Israeli conflict, which means normalizing relations between the entire Arab region and Israel in exchange for a complete withdrawal from the occupied territories, including East Jerusalem, and a just settlement of the Palestinian refugee problem. Well, this week we'll talk with Matt Duss about his personal perspectives on the state of the conflict and any prospects for breaking the deadlock, particularly in light of the collapsed U.S.-led efforts last year and the Palestinians' recent attempt to internationalize their campaign for statehood by joining the ICC, that is, the International Criminal Court, and other world bodies. Matthew Duss is no stranger to the Voice of America. In his capacity as senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, he was a frequent panelist at these microphones, and we are now delighted to welcome him as he takes the helm of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Matt Duss, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We're really delighted to have you, and congratulations on your new position.
Thank you.
Now, of course, there are many organizations here in Washington and around the world that are dedicated to bringing peace or trying to foment peace between Israelis and Palestinians. What distinguishes your particular organization?
Well, I think just to give a little bit of background, the foundation was created, as you said, in 1979 by a Washington lawyer and philanthropist named Merle Thorpe, Jr. Merle was a close friend of Senator William Fulbright and traveled with him in the Middle East and became very interested in Palestinian-Israeli peace and the broader Arab-Israeli conflict. And I think was motivated by a number of things, including the Camp David Accord, to just create an endowment to support the facilitation of peace between Palestinian Israelis and with the broader region. We're doing this in various ways. Historically, the foundation has supported speakers, brought people to Washington to raise awareness, to introduce people here in Washington, analysts, policymakers, lawmakers, to different perspectives. One of the main products of the foundation, starting in the early 90s, was a bi-monthly report on the growth of the settlements. I mean, the people who were running the foundation recognized, I think, very early on that the growth of the settlements, and I think everyone understands this now in the West Bank, was going to create a real problem for any final agreement. So that was a focus of the foundation for some years. I think now our focus is going to be more, certainly the settlements are an issue, but there's a whole range of final status issues that deserve attention. And with using new media tools, the internet, social media, our focus here is trying to amplify some of the efforts that are being done by Palestinian and Israeli groups on the ground over there right now. There's a number of great groups, many of whom we have relationships with and give some support to, addressing problems, coming up with real ideas, real solutions, and making people here in Washington aware of those groups.
Well, that's a very good point, and that is partly why we had General Amnon Reshef last week. He founded the Commanders for Israel Security, which is a group of over 150 senior retired military officers from the IDF and other security agencies in Israel, saying to their own political leadership, it's time for us to respond to the Arab Peace Initiative from 2002, mm-hmm. that the only way to have a two-state solution is to act now. The turmoil in the region, whether in Syria or with the self-proclaimed Islamic State, on the rise in Iraq and Syria, that really there is no time to lose. So I'd like to learn more about the organizations you're working with. Mm-hmm. Talk about these indigenous groups in Israel and Palestine.
Well, just to name two, and if I could just quickly address the point that Reshef made, yeah, I think that is a very important perspective. When we look at the region right now and, you know, the turmoil that the region's going under, I think there are two schools of thought. One, I think Reshef represents, I think, what I would say a very strong consensus in the security community, which is that there is an opportunity here, given that there are some common interests with Israel and some of the other surrounding states in addressing this problem of violent radical extremism. But the Palestinian issue has to be dealt with. That file has to be closed for those partnerships with Israel and these other Arab states to actually move beyond, because there's a very low ceiling on those relationships right now because of concern over the Palestinian issue. Whereas Netanyahu's view and the people close to Netanyahu seem to believe that because of all these other things going on in the region, they simply don't have to worry, or that they can just kind of put the Palestinian issue to the side, because I think it's very clear that Netanyahu, even though he kind of said the words Palestinian state back in 2009 through his subsequent actions and words, I think it's become very clear that he's not genuinely interested in getting to that end state, in creating a Palestinian state next to Israel. Getting to the groups that we're working with, one new group that we've started working with, it's called 972 MAG. Some people may be familiar with it. It's a group of progressive Israeli writers and journalists, mainly writing in English. There are Palestinian writers who write for them as well. I would encourage people to check out that website. They're doing on-the-ground reporting, analysis both of the situation in the occupied territories and the domestic scene within Israel as well.
And did you say there was another organization?
There another organization that we've been doing some work with is a group called Just Vision. They do work relating to Palestinian nonviolence both in the West Bank and in Jerusalem. They've put out a number of very, very good documentaries, including Budrus, was about a popular resistance effort in the West Bank, a small Palestinian village called Budrus, and their efforts to use nonviolent, unarmed resistance to oppose the takeover of their farmland by settlers and for the creation of the Israeli security wall. A lot of Americans have this idea in their mind of Palestinians that it's all violence. That's somewhat understandable given the experience of the Second Intifada when you had buses and restaurants and cafes blowing up. But I think it's very important for people to understand that you also have a very, very strong constituency that understands that nonviolent resistance and civil disobedience are the ways that Palestinians are going to achieve their national aspirations and their own human rights.
What about attempts now, in light of the collapsed U.S.-led talks, in light of this very unfortunate Gaza war that we witnessed last year, and now you have the Palestinians tried to join the International Criminal Court? How helpful or hurtful do you think this is? Of course, the United States is on record saying this is not helpful, mm-hmm. It's premature. Of course, the Israelis, it goes without saying, are not in favor of that. And those even sympathetic with Palestinians would say, well, understandable, you're frustrated, but it could backfire. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts as an organization?
Well, I think we're in a period right now where, I mean, it's possibly the lowest trust between two leaders of Palestinians and Israelis. Maybe it was worse between Sharon and Arafat. I think it may very well have been. But let's just say that right now these two leaders do not trust each other. And their trust in the United States, unfortunately, as a broker, is severely diminished. I would be careful about making equivalences here, though. I think we should step back and look what the Palestinians are doing. Yes, they're frustrated. They don't believe that Netanyahu is serious about an agreement. But for years, if we look at, you know, the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the international community made demands on the Palestinians, recognize Israel, and stop violence. And that is what the Palestinian Liberation Organization has done. You know, one can agree or disagree with this tactic of going to international institutions, of joining the International Criminal Court. But at the end of the day, I think people need to recognize that this is a nonviolent legal effort to achieve their rights. So they are, in a sense, doing exactly what has been asked of them. And if people have a better idea of how they should achieve their rights, I'd love to hear it. So, no, it's not optimal. I think the United States could do a much better job of addressing the power asymmetries that exist here. Israel is occupying Palestinian land. I think people understand that. It's important for people to understand the Israeli perspective, too, and their need for security. But I think, in a way, what the Palestinians are doing is both Abbas, as someone who's seen his own political legitimacy diminished and faith in his own leadership severely diminished by these endless rounds of negotiations that don't deliver anything tangible for Palestinians on the ground, he's struggling to find a way to advance the Palestinians' goals and guarding his own political flanks, while at the same time trying to find a way, in a sense, to make clear to the United States that his patience and his ability to wait for the United States to take up this issue again is gone.
What about the so-called unity agreement between Fatah, on the one hand, mm-hmm. the government in the West Bank, and then Hamas?
Right.
Now, most would say, you know, Hamas is the real spoiler here. Hamas, which governs Gaza, which does not recognize Israel as opposed to the Palestinian Authority. So Bibi Netanyahu, the current prime minister, maybe he won't be for long. We don't know. We'll see what happens with Israeli elections in March. That's also an important juncture. But where does this particular agreement stand? Is it working? Because, of course, the two have divergent views vis-a-vis the state of Israel.
No, I would say it's not working. I think there were signs early on that this was a perhaps more serious effort than we'd seen in the past. I think because of a number of things, the Gaza war being a huge factor. You know, when Hamas agreed to these demands back in April, they were under serious pressure. They agreed to these demands almost entirely on Abbas's terms. They agreed to this unity government or this transitional government, a consensus government, I think is more accurate to call it, on terms very, very favorable to Fatah. And there's a number of reasons for that. One, they had lost a number of patrons. The closing of the smuggling tunnels by Egypt had deprived Hamas of revenues, tax revenues, which they would take off the tunnel trade. They had no way to pay their own civil servants, and so they were facing a possible revolt if they didn't come to some agreement that was able to, you know, put money back into Gaza's coffers. Subsequently, we saw the kidnapping of the three Israeli teenagers in the West Bank. We saw a very extensive operation by the Israeli security forces in the West Bank, raiding homes, raiding villages, taking lots of prisoners. They said they were searching for the three boys. We know now that they were almost certainly sure that those boys were dead. But it was an effort to just kind of tamp down Hamas in the West Bank. And in response, you saw, you know, an upsurge of rockets from Gaza into Israel, an Israeli response, and it was just another escalation. And the particularly troubling thing, in addition to all the destruction and death and casualties we saw during the war, was that Hamas came out of that with a bump in popular opinion. You know, they went into the Gaza war on their heels and came out of it. Now, that's not to say that everyone in Gaza loves Hamas. I don't think they do. I think there's polling evidence that shows that. I have anecdotal evidence, just people I talk to. But people in Gaza see themselves in such a hopeless condition under this blockade for all these years that there's a sense in which they admire any attempt to change the status quo, even one that ends up bringing negative consequences on them. But where we are now with regard to the reconciliation agreement, I think it's pretty much nowhere. There was some talk about addressing the situation in Gaza, putting the Palestinian Authority in charge of the crossings to help with the economic redevelopment. There needs to be some formula for reconstructing and redeveloping Gaza, unless we want to be back at another war within 2 years. And unfortunately, it seems that, you know, after the war, people were paying attention to it. And now it's kind of back in the drawer. Again, one of the things that we are focusing on at the foundation is trying to keep people aware that, you know, this problem is not going away just because we're onto other things. As you know, as a journalist, it's the nature of news to kind of focus on what's the big story. But I think people need to understand that this problem in Gaza continues to simmer. I think it's true of, you know, Israel, Palestine more broadly. This problem continues to simmer. But I think Gaza is particularly problematic just because you have Hamas that's barely holding on to control. You have extremist groups that are even worse than Hamas waiting to challenge Hamas. But there needs to be some way of reconnecting the West Bank and Gaza politically and economically, because if we do want a two-state solution, you have to find some way to reunify the Palestinian national movement.
Do you see any possibility for Hamas leadership to meet the minimum demands that Israel would require, that is to renounce violence and to at least recognize the state of Israel within 67 borders with some kind of adjustments?
Hamas has shown that it is willing to stop violence periodically. It has honored truces. And you look at the way that Israel has dealt with Hamas, and Israel by its own behavior has shown that it recognizes that Hamas can control the security of its territory. So when Benjamin Netanyahu equates ISIS with Hamas, I would just note that by his own behavior, he's shown that that's not true. Because no one's saying we should just negotiate with ISIS and let them control Western Iraq. But still, the way Israeli policy is basically to keep Hamas in control of Gaza, contained within Gaza, certainly.
Although ideally, I'm sure they would prefer that Fatah would be in control.
Oh, certainly. They would prefer to have a group in control that was not periodically shooting rockets into Israel. There's no question. But as to your question, my own view is that there should be one condition for bringing Hamas into the negotiation, and it's that question of violence. End to terrorism and end to rockets. As for asking them to recognize Israel, I mean, there are parties in the Israeli government that do not recognize a Palestinian state. In fact, they're like Naftali Bennett's party, the Jewish Home Party. They explicitly reject the creation of a Palestinian state. So I think it's really unfair to demand that any party that joins a Palestinian government meet this standard while not making the same demand of Israeli parties.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Matthew Duss. He's president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. That's a nonprofit organization based here in Washington, created to promote a just solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, connect with us on Facebook, or send an old-fashioned email to PCUSA@voanews.com. Well, here's a shout-out to a loyal listener from beautiful Istanbul, Halil Zeren. Teşekkür ederim. So back to you, Matthew Duss, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. Let's turn to the region itself, how the turmoil, whether it's in Iraq with Daesh, also known as Islamic State, ISIS, and the complete, almost, it seems, the destruction of the Syrian state. Let's see where things go. And that borders, of course, on Israel. And we have Egypt now under a military leadership, even more, one could argue, harsh and draconian than Mubarak. How does all of this affect the Palestinian-Israeli situation? Let me also add the transition in Saudi Arabia from King Abdullah, who recently passed away, to his successor, King Salman. What about Saudi Arabia's position vis-a-vis the conflict? Is the Arab Peace Initiative still on the table? How do you see anything changing?
Well, first, on how the regional turmoil has impacted the Palestinian-Israeli issue, it has both marginalized it to some extent, but it's also made clear of its continuing salience amongst Arabs more broadly in the region. As one Israeli friend of mine put it, it remains important just because if the Arab Spring showed us anything, it showed us how much many of these Arab rulers fear their people. They will continue, as I referenced earlier, the low ceiling that exists on Israel's relationships with many of these Arab states. That ceiling is low because these leaders, even though they are not democratic, they do have to manage their public's opinion. Even authoritarian states have to do that, and they recognize that their public's opinions are very supportive of Palestinians and very against the Israeli occupation. And this goes to the United States as well, because we're partners with Israel, we are partners with many of these Arab states, we have some common interests. This is basic analysis that the foundation was created for, was, you know, yes, it's in the interest of Israelis and Palestinians to achieve an end to this conflict, but it's also strongly in the interest of the United States. And I think we see evidence of this from time to time. It's important not to overstate it, but I think if we go back to, say, General Petraeus's testimony before Congress back in 2010.
So General Petraeus was the former
head of CENTCOM, the Central Command, the unit in charge of the Middle East region.
Absolutely.
And he said, as we try to work with these governments, The irresolution of the Palestinian-Israeli conflict will continue to create costs for us. Again, his successor, General Mattis, every day in the Middle East, the United States pays a security price. Those are his words, for the irresolution of this conflict. Now, that's not to say the United States should withdraw its support from Israel. Certainly not. I think we should keep as many allies as we can. But it does suggest that we have an interest in pushing Israel and the Palestinians in various ways toward resolving this conflict. And the United States is the only one that can give Israel the security guarantees that it will absolutely need in any agreement. So to that extent, the United States remains the key player in this.
Well, if that's the case, do you see any appetite for that in the last 2 years of President Obama's administration? He already tried once, maybe even twice. The talks, as we said, ended in collapse last year. Mutual recriminations, Israel being blamed, Israel blaming the Palestinians. Mm-hmm. The point is things are in a dire situation, and now we're looking at elections in Israel. Do you see any opportunity if there is a change in government? And would a change in government, that is, a different coalition, make a difference, do you think, in terms of pursuing peace talks? Because right now the coalition organized by Benjamin Netanyahu doesn't seem to be in favor of moving forward, or at least not in the way that the Palestinians are prepared to accept.
Yeah. I think it would make a difference. I wouldn't go as far as say it would make the decisive difference, but certainly, in my view, were you to have, for example, a government headed by the Labor Hatnua coalition of Itzhak Herzog and Tzipi Livni, both people who I think have demonstrated they're genuinely supportive and genuinely interested in getting to a two-state solution. But I also think you would need some other things. Let's look, for example, at what the European Union has been doing. And I think that's a very, very important factor. In some ways, the European Union has been starting to play more of a bad cop role here. Because one of the problems you have is currently, Israel, all things considered, is in a pretty good place. That's not to say that the neighborhood is great. There's a lot going on. But Israel has the most powerful military in the region by several orders of magnitude. It has issues on its borders from time to time. But in general, things are pretty good. The economy is doing fine. They have some social and economic issues they're working out. Many democracies do. But still, they have this occupation where they keep millions of Palestinians in this sort of stateless limbo where they do not have human rights, or they're mistreated. It's a daily humiliation and form of violence. But your average Israeli feels no real costs for this. And when there are no costs for not making a very hard decision, chances are any human being is going to just say, okay, well, I don't have to make that decision. So I think what the EU is doing by moving forward, considering penalties for settlements by choosing not to do business with Israeli organizations that operate in the occupied territories. I think this is a really important step because it's not a boycott of Israel. It's not singling Israel out. It's just saying, you know, our laws prevent us from doing business, recognizing that settlements in occupied territories are a violation of international law. They're a violation of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So it's a way of saying, okay, if this continues, there will start to be real costs. And I think once your average Israeli voter starts to understand that this situation is going to create costs that could potentially hit his or her pocketbook, I think that could help change the dynamic.
Well, also we note that Sweden back in October voted to officially recognize the state of Palestine. The British Parliament did so, but non-binding vote. I think the French also considered it or perhaps passed something. What I'm trying to say is these are more symbolic gestures, but also rather significant in the vein of what you were just saying.
Right. And I think they are symbolic, but I think, and this is what has people like Netanyahu concerned, is once you kind of get through all those symbolic issues, then you're left with real issues. So once they tick these things off, they will start moving into actual substantive steps. So I think the Europeans have been signaling in various ways that they've got much less patience with Israel's refusal to end the occupation. It's embedding itself in the occupied territories ever more deeply by expanding settlements. And they're ready to kind of start shifting their policy something a bit more aggressive.
Whether one is more pro-Israeli or pro-Palestinian, one can be both pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian.
Quite right.
And that is a problem because we try to make this artificial dichotomy. I think anyone would agree that these settlements are really a major impediment. And maybe initially they were created to provide some sort of security for Israel, but they are now a major impediment. And if Israel can get rid of the settlements in Gaza and Sinai, many good friends of Israel say, well, they can probably do the same thing in the West Bank. So here's the point. Let's say we are able to make some sort of an agreement on the settlements because they have to go for a two-state solution, for a contiguous Palestinian state. Let's assume that that is doable, land swaps and so forth. The question to you, Matt Duss, is the following. What about Jerusalem, the status of Jerusalem, very sacrosanct to Jews around the world and Israelis, but I would argue probably not so sacrosanct that some sort of a compromise couldn't be made, but not for so-called true believers. So what about the status of Jerusalem? What would the Palestinians minimally accept? You hear Benjamin Netanyahu saying Jerusalem will never be divided. I don't know to what extent that's representative of the majority of Israelis. And then there's the question of the so-called right of return of, of refugees. These are also very sticky.
Yeah, those are two of the toughest issues.
Right.
First on Jerusalem, I think it's very important to understand that after, you know, 2,000 years of exile, for many people, Jews, Christians, others alike, the idea of Jews being back in Jerusalem, a place that they were prohibited from being, a place that was central in the creation of their national identity, has a great, great deal of meaning. As to the idea of, you know, never dividing Jerusalem, I think if you go to Jerusalem, as I do several times a year, Jerusalem is, to a great extent, already divided. You have a road that runs essentially down the 67 line, the green line. Most Jews live in West Jerusalem. Most Palestinians live in East Jerusalem. They can travel because it's an open city. But to a great extent, they stay divided on those two different sides. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing, but I would say that in terms of dividing jurisdiction by putting Palestinian neighborhoods under Palestinian control, and yes, East Jerusalem as a capital of a Palestinian state is a red line for Palestinians, in as much as Jerusalem has great, great value and significance in Jewish history. So it won't be easy, but I think just recognizing that and recognizing how harmful it is for Palestinians to constantly hear Israeli leaders say that we will never divide this, you will never get this, it really diminishes any Palestinian trust of the Israelis. But by the same token, if we're talking about the right of return, and again, important to understand, we're talking about around 700,000 Palestinians who were fled or were expelled around the 1948 War of Independence, as Israel call it, or the Nakba, the catastrophe, as Palestinians call it, and were not allowed to return to their homes, which then became part of Israel. And it's now there are several millions of descendants of these refugees. And this idea of being able to return has become a really central component of Palestinian national identity. Many Palestinians keep the keys to the homes. Mm-hmm. They pass them down through the generations with the idea that one day will we go back to these homes. But I think there is a recognition. And I think if you look at the polling, it shows amongst Palestinians, if there's a two-state agreement, if they can have their rights, if they can actually have their own state, what they really want more than anything, more than actually physically going back and taking back the home, is a recognition of what happened. But at the end of the day, we're dealing with an issue of politics. We're dealing with an issue of national identity. So I think there are formulas on both of these very tough questions, on Jerusalem, on the right of return. You know, it's the nature of any negotiation. No one's going to get everything that they want. In fact, many people will be unhappy with what they get at the end of the day. But the question is, will they get enough to satisfy their basic demands and their national aspirations? And I believe the answer is yes.
Well, on that relatively optimistic note, that is all the time we have. Matt Duss is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. That's a nonprofit organization to promote peace and justice for Israelis and Palestinians. Matt Duss, thank you so much for sharing your insights, and we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guest. Our engineer was Nick Ivanov. And I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. From Washington, D.C., the nation's capital, the Voice of America has brought you Press Conference USA. You can email your questions or comments about this edition of Press Conference USA to pcusa@voanews.com. And to keep up with all the latest news, tune to the Voice of America on radio, television, or the World Wide Web. Join us again next week when another newsmaker speaks with journalists about the critical issues facing the United States and the world. We'll see you next week for another edition of Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.